Weakened by Democratic losses in last week's midterms, President Obama headed overseas, as we mentioned, to India, then eventually on to meet with world leaders at the G20 summit in Seoul. In the past, presidents constrained on domestic issues, frequently focused on foreign policy, where they have more room to maneuver. So do priorities change after the midterms? Where are their prospects for real change? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Lauren Jenkins is NPR Senior Foreign Editor, and he joins us here in Studio 3A. Lauren, nice to have you back on the program.
It's nice to be here.
And what difference does it make now that Republicans control the House Foreign Affairs Committee?
Well, I don't think there'll be great differences. There may be some atmospherics on something like Cuba, since the new head of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House is a Cuban-American from Florida,
who's
very strong, Ileana Ross Layton. And I think if President Obama had had a big Cuban initiative, that might be dead in the water. In fact, he made some early talk about trying to review and reform the U.S.-Cuban relations, but in fact, he's done very little. As I think he's done very little across the board in foreign policy since he's been in. I think one reason was he had competing agendas. Was he going to try to do something on the world stage or deal with his domestic agenda? And I think he realized he couldn't do both, and he put all of his efforts into his domestic agenda, as we know, and pretty much has followed Bush foreign policy across the board in the world in foreign affairs.
There would be a distinct difference in tone, at least in terms of his relations with Israel compared to President Bush.
Well, there were. You know, he began with his historic speech in Cairo to the Muslim of the world and trying to set a new vision of dealing with the whole issue of Islam and obviously Jerusalem, you know, Israel and the Palestinians. But once he tried to get the ball rolling on that, he pretty much lost steam, was outmaneuvered, and didn't push through much. As I say, what's ended up being is pretty much a continuation of policy that, you know, various administrations have followed on the Middle East. I don't see any great changes. We're still nowhere near getting a solution of the Israeli-Palestinian problem through peace negotiations. They're stalled. We're getting out of Iraq slowly, but that was already initiated by the Bush administration. We've accelerated our engagement in Afghanistan. There's some nice words that may try to start downsizing next year, but that remains to be seen. I think, you know, it's deeds, not words, that we have to look at.
The administration was, during the campaign, then-candidate Obama said he would reach out to the so-called rogue states of the world, including Iran.
And what we've had in Iran is a continuation of Bush policy, which is not reaching out, except for a few nice gestures. In fact, this administration has followed very stiff sanctions against Iran policy that just doesn't differ that much from the past administration. And relations have gone nowhere.
Some would point out opportunities offered to the Iranians to make compromises that were rebuffed.
Absolutely. The Iranians aren't great players at this game, but, you know, the initiative should have, one could argue, should have been continued by this administration if they really wanted to change. You can't approach the Iranians and say, you know, we want you to stop developing nuclear weapons. We want to open a conversation with you. At the same time, you're passing sanctions that are trying to break their economy.
Because they're developing nuclear weapons.
Yeah, because they're developing nuclear weapons. But from the Iranian point of view, that doesn't show great opening, a great opening for, you know, for conversations and for reform.
President Obama and candidate Obama were greeted with great enthusiasm in Europe. How is he viewed there today?
I think they're great questions. I think they admired him. It was a change. His personality was great, but it hasn't really produced any great new changes. The one area it has was with Russia. I think he's mended the Russian relations with Russia that had frazzled over the years. He's had a new, he sort of reset the U.S.-Russian dialogue through conversations about renewing a New START treaty for nuclear reductions. trade. I think that's his one success.
Where does the START Treaty stand? It was submitted to the Senate.
It is for the Senate to approve or disapprove, and that could change with the election. The Senate is no longer as strongly Democratic as it was. There may be people who oppose it.
There is a two-thirds majority needed to approve a treaty?
Yes.
That's going to be difficult to round up. Is it possible that could be pushed through in the lame duck session before we get the new Congress in January?
There's so many issues for that lame duck session. I would doubt that they would get to the START Treaty.
Some people would say the principal relation that the United States has to consider is its relations with China. And there we've seen, in terms of some trade relations, some improvements, but also some stiffening on some strategic issues, military issues.
A lot of tensions over the devaluation or the need to revalue the yuan, the Chinese currency, over the trade imbalances. There's been a lot of tension.
And indeed, a lot of tension on the South China Sea, where the United States has said it supports a policy which includes all the claims of the other half dozen nations that claim all or part of that area and wants freedom of navigation. Yeah. China says those are Chinese waters.
Exactly. And the rest of Asia thinks they're not. So there's a whole new issue developing there. Just recently at the ASEAN talks, the U.S. sided with all the other Southeast Asian nations over the freedom of navigation in those waters.
The other, of course, issues with China are economic. China continues to be the most important holder of American debt.
Absolutely.
And China has, some would say, a veto over American policies in some respects.
Well, they are certainly the emerging second superpower. And increasingly we're seeing challenges from China, and they're asserting themselves through their economic power and growing military power.
Is Japan a diminishing power?
Absolutely. I mean, one hardly talks about it today. And you know, China is the engine, the economic engine of Asia now, the way Japan was 20 years ago. It's just the total power has shifted.
An email question from Sarah takes us to another realm, and that is Africa. In 12 days, Obama is due to share with us his strategy for dealing with the LRA, that's the Lord's Resistance Army, in the Congo, the army that steals young children and trains them to kill their parents and others. I look forward to seeing him take a strong action to help those forgotten children. This would be a legacy this Republican would love to see him leave.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I think the U.S. is a diminishing power, and I don't think we've quite perceived that, and I don't know that our politicians have. I think, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, the confrontation with Iran, North Korea, the message should be that there are certain things that U.S. power can't accomplish. And I think, you know, what sort of initiative do you have in Africa to deal with rebels? It's a real question. You know, we haven't been very successful at projecting our power in recent decades.
And have not really tried in Africa, with the sole exception, I guess, of Somalia.
Somalia, which was a disaster.
And the situation then in Darfur, the United States is not going to be able to influence the situation there?
I don't think so. It's hard to see what they can do.
And the continuing debacle in the Congo?
Boy, that's one. I don't know how one resolves that. The Africans can't resolve it. Before independence, the European powers couldn't resolve it, and I don't know how we are going to resolve it. It's a huge mess where all the neighbors of the Congo are clawing into it for some of its great mineral resources, and because there's no strong central government, it's anarchy on the periphery.
We're talking with NPR Foreign Affairs editor, senior foreign editor, Lauren Jenkins, about foreign affairs in the Obama administration after the midterms. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. I'm Jed with us from Fayetteville in Arkansas.
Hi. You had mentioned President Obama's relationship perhaps being more strained with Israel, but I would just like to offer that I don't believe that any amount of pressure that the president could have exerted over Israel at the time could possibly survive any kind of Republican intercession after the elections. You know, the United States is, you know, essentially been emasculated by Israel and you know, we hold absolutely no leverage whatsoever any longer. And I think it's extremely discouraging, because you're talking about negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis, which is negotiations between the powerless and the extremely powerful. And the Palestinians, the only thing they had going for them was the influence of President Obama, and you know, Israel's completely indefensible process of settlement building and house demolition goes on completely unabated, and I think it's extremely discouraging. And when I saw the election results, I thought, you know, whatever nails had been starting to pry out of that coffin were getting nailed right back in, and I find it extremely disturbing.
Amjad, of course, you know that there are people who would put that completely the other way, and many of them voted that way in the last election. But to his point, Lauren Jenkins.
Well, you know, the peace process in the Middle East has been going on for decades and decades and going nowhere, because there really is no – there are two very distinct points of view and two peoples claiming the same lands. They can't find any points of agreement on both sides. The Israelis will argue that the Palestinians aren't ready for statehood, aren't able to control themselves. They're divided between Gaza and the West Bank. They're prone to, in the Israeli view, to terrorism if they're not kept under occupation. There are the arguments, the religious biblical arguments, that the West Bank really goes back to, belongs to the old state of Israel. And on the Palestinian sides, you're right. Their argument is they're powerless. They've been occupied. They've been pushed off their lands. And they argue that it's the Israelis who don't want to settle and don't want to give up the lands they occupied after the 67 war. As I say, it's a really difficult dispute, because no one's talking to each other, and each side is determined that their view is the only one that has valid.
Thanks, Amjad, for the call.
Sure, thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. There are some situations that do not get better with time. And perhaps the Middle East is one of them. Demographic changes will occur there, which might make it more difficult to resolve the issue, as well as continuing Israeli construction. As more settlements go up, it gets difficult for Israel to even contemplate the idea of surrendering that territory.
Absolutely. You know, there was for a long time after the Oslo Accords the idea that you could have a two-state solution. You could separate the Palestinians from the Israelis, give up the settlements and go back to the lands as they were divided up to the 67 war. As time has passed, I remember, you know, 30 years ago talking to Meron Ben-Benisti, who was then the deputy mayor of Jerusalem, and he said, we were talking about settlement expansion, which then was very small. He said, you know, if 100,000 Israelis ever settle in the West Bank, it's over. There can be no two-state solution. Well, now you're talking half, you know, there are 500,000 settlers that are gone. It's going to be very hard to separate, very painful. It's hard to see how it happens. In fact, a lot of the debate now on the Palestinian side is they should give up the idea of two-state solution, say, make us all one state, and they're counting on their population growing greater than the Israelis, and at some point, if Israel is to remain a democracy, they would have a majority vote. And that's becoming a much more current issue day by day as
which
the settlements continue.
Why you hear demands from the Israeli side to maintain the Jewish character of the state. Iran. Iran is trying to be constrained in its development of nuclear weapons. Eventually, they're going to get there.
I think so. I think in this day and age, you know, the genie's out of the bottle. Any nation with resources and you know, trained scientific group, the knowledge is there. They're going to go for it. If you look at it from the Iranian side, they have been traditionally over history, 5,000 years, a regional power in the Middle East in various ups and downs historically. To be a player today, they look at it and they say there's Israel, which has nuclear weapons. If they want to get their point of view and exert their influence on the area, which traditionally they always have had, the only way they can see doing it is also by possessing a nuclear bomb. Not that it would necessarily be used, who knows about that, but by having it, they would get a seat at the table and be treated somewhat differently than they are today in the political councils and settling issues in the Middle East.
Understand why. You could also understand why some may not wish them to have nuclear weapons.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And speaking of states that have nuclear weapons, you look at North Korea, and not next week, maybe not next year, maybe not 10 years from now. This is utterly unsustainable.
Well, the whole issue of nuclear power in the future is unsustainable if you really, you know, if you really look down at the dangers that it poses, of somebody doing something wrong, someone making a miscalculation, someone pushing the wrong button. There are going to be more nations with nuclear weapons, and there's not, it's hard to see what one can do to stop them. You can't go to war each time some nation decides they're going to build a nuclear weapon, or we'd be in wars across the globe.
We would have been in wars with India and Pakistan.
We would have been in wars with India and Pakistan, indeed.
And both allies of the United States now.
Yep.
Lauren Jenkins, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
NPR Senior Foreign Editor Lauren Jenkins with us here in Studio 3A. President Obama wraps up his visit to India. Stay tuned for more coverage on that later today on All Things Considered. Tomorrow, we'll review the job review. Plus, pianist and composer Randy Weston will join us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.